There were, besides, beans and potatoes, melons and chilies, and I was well pleased with them and the silver coins I had received in exchange. I no longer sold to Bezois. There were several other shops in the town now where I was paid better, and where I did not have to endure the sly, spiteful observations he made. Increasing years had added more grease to his bulk, more flesh to his paunch. They had not sweetened his nature or endowed him with more kindliness. Confounding the curses that came his way, and there were many, for his usury was harsh beyond necessity, he continued to prosper, squeezing the life from those hapless creatures who were driven to borrow from him, and gaining his strength from their weakness. Seeing me pass, he came and stood in the doorway and called, "Rukmani, I have news for you. Stop a minute." "What is it?" "Kenny is back. I have seen him." "So," I said warily, "that is good news for everybody." "Especially for you," he said, keeping his eye on me. "For everybody," I repeated, "for he is a good doctor. Many people are in his debt." "He is also a man," he said. "They say he is a good friend to you." "To me and mine," I said with rising temper, "he has done much for us." "For you particularly," he insisted, his flabby lips twitching with innuendo. "I have heard from Kunti that this is so." "A whore's tale," I said contemptuously, "as suspect as her body." He thrust his face up to mine. "Yet not for that reason dismissed," he said, leering. I wanted to strike him. I wanted to ram his words back into his throat. I held myself still with an effort. "Foul-mouthed pig," I said, "carrion crow." He only smiled, being used to such harsh words. "As hot-headed as ever, Rukmani," he said. "Where will you turn when you need money next?" He was so slippery, so worthless, that my anger died. Not even the malignant power of Kunti could rouse me. I felt too remote. I hung about for a while, unable to make up my mind whether to try to seek him in the town or whether to go home in prudence and await his coming, as I felt he sure would. Then it struck me as ludicrous that at this stage I should walk with caution, and I went therefore to the whitewashed cottage on the fringes of the town, expectant, carrying a garland of roses and jasmine to welcome him, and a lime for good luck. The cottage was bare. It had always been, and chill and lifeless from long disuse. Dust lay thick on the floor. There were neat hillocks of chipped cement, and the earth where bandicoots, for some obscure reason of their own, had dug. So much I saw from the broken window. Then I pushed open the door to enter. Kenny was standing in the smaller room that led off the main one. He turned when he heard me come in. I saw him frown. "How did you know I was here?" Accustomed through, though I was to him, the brusque words, his short manner dashed the welcome from my lips. "Bezois told me," I said. "I came at once." There was a silence. The garland I was holding became an encumbrance. I felt I had been stupid to buy it. Even the lime seemed unnecessary. I tried to hide them behind my back. He noticed at once. "What have you got there?" "A few things. I have just been to the market," I began lamely. "A garland, is it not?" "Yes," I said sheepishly. "I bought it for you. You guessed well." He drew me to the window and pointed. Outside lay a heap of garlands, roses, lilies, chrysanthemums. Evidently, others had been here before me. "Not a guess," he said gravely. "A certainty. You were not the first." Well-intentioned for all that. I was beginning hotly when he began to laugh, grinning widely so that the lines of his face were somehow lost in the creases of laughter, making him look young and amiable. I felt better at once. The strangeness vanished. "You have been away for a long time," I said. "Too long. We have missed you." "Why?" he said. "More trouble?" I was in two minds as to what to say and looked covertly at him. His face had become very serious, almost grim, with every trace of laughter taken from it. After so many years, he was as unpredictable as ever. "We have had our troubles," I said cautiously. "Yet it was not only on that account we missed you. It was..." I stopped, not knowing how to finish. He would have helped us in our need with food and money and skill, yet it was something more than this that he offered us, and I could not find words for it. "Your presence," I said haltingly, "means a lot to us. There is a rare gentleness in you, the sweeter for its brief appearances. I do not know what emboldened me. Perhaps it was his silence. He seemed to be hardly listening. He was still standing, looking out the window, biting his nails. Troubles, he said. We all have them. I suppose the crops failed and you starved. It was a bad time, I answered him. We lost 2 sons. Raha died by an accident. The child was too tender for this world. He could not live as we did. After the crops failed, he... I stopped again. The memory of those days was ever with me, yet the passing of time had made it quiescent. Now my own words brought it savagely alive with the shrill, stabbing pain that swept the words away. I was quiet for a while, waiting for it to fade, to regain calmness. He did not look round. Perhaps he sensed my struggle. Enough of me, I said at last. What of you and yours? He turned on me roughly. What concern is that of yours? None, save that I wish them well. Save your wishes, he said unpleasantly. My wife has left me. My sons have been taught to forget me. I tried and failed to imagine her. This woman who could, after so many years, renounce altogether her husband, break the bond that must surely have existed despite his long absences. Perhaps it is just this that has driven her to it, I thought. He is without blame. You think it is my fault? He said. Do not deny it. Your face speaks plainly enough for me. Women need men, I said, shrugging. It is not right to deprive a woman. Tell me also, he said, do you not think a man must choose his work? Such a man as you? Yes, I replied. What then if his wife cannot accompany him? Cannot, I said. She must. A woman's place is with her husband. He sighed impatiently. You simplify everything, being without understanding. Your views are so limited that it is impossible to explain to you. Limited, yes, I agreed, yet not wholly without understanding. Our ways are not your ways. For you have sound instincts, he said. For the first time since I had known him, I saw a spark of admiration in his eyes. I am not a fool, I said, speaking in a low voice, pleased by the commendation in his eyes, a little hurt by it as well. Have I not so much sense to see that you are not one of us? You live and work here, and there is in your heart solicitude for us and love for our children. But this is not your country, and we are not your people. If you lived here your whole life, it still would not be. My country, he said. Sometimes I do not know which is my country. Until today, I had thought perhaps it was this. He sounded bitter and weary. His forlorn spirit touched mine, and a great emptiness seemed to unfold in me. I wished I could have my words back, locked away safely in myself, unsaid, powerless to wound. Save your regrets, he said. You have told me nothing I did not know. I rose to go. My husband and children will be happy to see you. We shall be glad to welcome you in our house. You are not without riches, as I have said before, he said, speaking half to himself. How is your daughter? She was a pretty young woman. Well, she is carrying. So her coming to me was not in vain. Had she been barren forever, it would have been better. Why? Was it not your wish? Not this way, I said, with the father any one of a dozen men. I suppose it was necessary, he said quietly. I have seen it happen before. She would go, I replied. She was devoted to the child. She would go. But of course she knew nothing, being inexperienced in such matters, and now she is with child. She conceived quickly. You will feel better when it is born, he said. A baby is no worse for being conceived in an encounter. You may be right, I said bitterly, but you do not realize the shame of it. People have not spared us. He stared at me impatiently. This is all you can think of? What people will say? One goes from one end of the world to the other to hear the same story. Does it matter what people say? His tone was contemptuous. Well, I thought, it's easy for you, but perhaps not quite so simple for us. I walked home, musing over what he had said, and presently it seemed to me that there was a truth in his words, and I felt a little comforted. Nathan had said much the same thing. He and Kenny, so different in other ways, were yet united in their views about this. Chapter 19. Kenny's return was the beginning of another change in our lives, and in Selvam's. Selvam, who for all that he had been reared on the land and had the earth in his blood, yet did not take to farming. Like his brothers, he was hard-working and conscientious, but he had no love for it, and in return it did not yield to him. He had a knowledge of crops and seasons, born of experience, but where crops thrived under Nathan's hand, under Selvam's they wilted. Despite anxious care, the seed he planted did not sprout. The plants that sprouted did not bear. One day, he came straight from working in the fields, threw down the spade he was carrying, and announced he was finished with the land. "I am no farmer," he said. "The land has no liking for me, and I have no time for it." "What then will you do, my son?" I said, worried. "How will you live when we are gone?" He did not reply at once, but sat down cross-legged, looking out absently beyond the small courtyard to the cool green of the paddy fields. But he was not thinking of them. "Kenny is building a hospital," he said. "When it is ready, he will need an assistant, and he has offered me the job." "But what can you know of such work?" "Nothing. He is going to train me, starting as soon as possible. He says it will not be too difficult for me, for I am not without learning." It was true. Selvam had been cast in the same mold as his brothers. He had quickly learned what I had to teach him and had progressed from there by his own efforts and enthusiasm. Study came to him naturally. He wrote and read, as I once did, avidly with pleasure. "He will learn," I thought. "This is the chance he has been waiting for." Selvam began to fidget. "I have told my father," he said hesitantly. "He is very willing." I smiled at him. "So am I. I wish you well." He relaxed. "I'm glad. I thought you might were displeased." "Not displeased, perhaps disappointed, since all our sons have forsaken the land. But it is the best way for you." "It is the best way," he repeated after me. "It will be a great venture. We have so many plans and much hope." We both relapsed into silence. I watched him covertly, wondering whether I should say, "You must be prepared. This new association will not be taken at face value. There will be vilifiers who will say it was not done for you, but for your mother, who will seek to destroy your peace." But then, I thought resolutely, I will not take the fire from his resolve or sow suspicion between them, and so I held my peace. But his steady eyes were on me, calm and level. "I am not unaware," he said quietly, "but it is not sufficient that you have the strength and I have trust." "It is indeed," I said with relief. "I wanted only that you should know." We smiled at each other in perfect understanding. I sought Kenny out again. "We are once more in your debt. My son is overjoyed. This is something he has waited for without knowing it." "I am indebted to him as well. I need an assistant. He promises to be a good one, and will, I hope, he will be the first of many." "I could not carry on alone. The town has grown, and is still growing, as you know." "It will be bigger than what went before. It will be a hospital, not a dispensary," he said coldly. "Let me show you." He pulled out several papers, drawings, and long sheets covered with calculations, which I could not even understand when he explained them. Though this I did not confess. I gathered only that it would be a big affair. "Where is the money to come from?" I said, bewildered. "Such a construction will need I do not know how many hundreds of rupees." "I have thousands," he replied. "I did not realize. You have lived like us, the poor." "The money is not mine. It has been given to me. I have collected it while I have been away." "In your country," I said, "from your people?" "Yes," he said impatiently. "Part of it came from my country and my people, part of it from yours. Why do you look puzzled?" "I have little understanding," I replied humbly. "I do not know why people who have not seen us and who not know us should do this for you." "Because they have the means," he said, "and because they have learned of your need. Do not let the sick die in the streets because there is no hospital for them? Are not children born in the gutters?" "I have told you before," he said. "I will not repeat it again. You must cry out for help if you want it. It is no use whatsoever to suffer in silence. Who will succor the drowning man if he does not clamor for his life?" "It is said," I began, Never mind what is said or what you have been told. There is no grandeur in want or in endurance. Privately, I thought, well, and what if we gave in to our troubles at every step? We would be pitiable creatures indeed to be so weak, for is not a man's spirit given to him to rise above his misfortunes? As for our wants, there are so many and unfilled, for who is so rich and so compassionate as to supply them? Want is our companion from birth to death, familiar as the seasons of or the earth, varying only in degree. What profit to bewail that which has already been and cannot change? His eyes narrowed, whether from our long association or from many dealings with human beings, and whether one kept silent or spoke to cloak one's thoughts, he always knew the heart of the matter. Acquiescent imbeciles, he said scornfully, do you think spiritual grace comes from being in want or from suffering? What thoughts have you when your belly is empty or your body is sick? Tell me they are the noble ones, and I will call you a liar. Yet our priests fast and enlist on themselves several punishments, and we are taught to bear our sorrows in silence. And all this is so that our soul may be cleansed. He struck his forehead. Oh, my God, he cried. I do not understand you. I never will. Go before I am too entangled in your philosophies. Chapter 20. Not in the town, where all that was natural had long been sacrificed, but on its outskirts, one could still see the passing of the seasons. For in the town there were the crowds, and the streets battened down upon the earth, and the filth that the men had put upon it. And one walked with care for what might lie beneath one's feet, or threaten from before or behind, and in the preoccupation forgot to look at the sun or the stars, or even to observe they had changed their setting in the sky, and knew nothing of the passage of time save in dry frenzy by looking at a clock. But for us, who lived by the green, quiet fields, perilously close though these were to the town, nature still gave its muted message. Each passing day, each week, each month, left its sign, clear and unmistakable. The tender budding of our new year, the periwinkles and the jasmine, the soft-scented champak blossom, had yielded place to the fierce-flowering jacaranda and gold mohur, before Ira's time came for giving birth. When my daughter was in labor, I erected the bamboo paling outside to warn my husband and son, as is the custom for those who have only one room and one dwelling. And when I had scoured the hut and poured wet dung on it, I brought out the pallet of plaited straw I myself had used for Ira to lie on, and went and gathered the petals the trees had shaken upon them, and took them to her, a vivid basket of layer upon layer of gold and red, mauve, and purple. A child of summer, I said, should be sturdy. She smiled and laid her hands on the petals. He is, I feel it. While I waited, I thought the other births this very hut had seen. First Ira herself, then the long, long interval, and after that, almost every passing year I bore a son. There had been hope and expectation, perhaps some anxiety before each birth. They were natural feelings, but now fears came swarming about my head like the black flying ants after a storm, and I cowered from the beat of their wings. A child conceived in an encounter fares no worse than a child born in wedlock, so Kenny had said. But could one be sure? A man takes his wife with passion, as is his nature, yet he is gentle with her. Amid the fire of breast on breast and bared thigh on thigh, he still can hold himself and give as much as he takes, leaving the exultant flesh unbruised. The woman is his wife, not only now for this surging experience, but tomorrow and the next year. She will carry his seed, and he will see her fruitful. Watched while day by day his child grows within her. And so he is tender and careful, and comes to her clean, that their fulfillment may be rich and blessed. But the man who finds a woman in the street, raises an eyebrow and snaps his fingers so that she follows him, throws her a few coins that he may possess her, holds her unresisting whatever he does to her. For this is what he has paid for. What cares such a man for the woman who is his for a